Funding for Here and Now Anytime comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Wonderful to have you with us on Here and Now Anytime, where we lean in with some news of the day to keep you up to speed and kick back with some arts, music, and culture to lift your spirits. So go ahead and subscribe and follow. We've got a lot ahead for you today.
There's been growing understanding that Netanyahu is making decisions that are more connected to his own political survival and not to Israel's national security interest.
The Political Balancing Act and the political implications of the U.S. support of Israel and Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu. Friday. It is March 29th from NPR and WBUR Boston. Welcome to Here and Now Anytime. I'm Shirley Jihad. On today's episode, the arrival of spring is always extra special in D.C. with the blossoming cherry trees, those postcard perfect pink blooms. But this year is a little bittersweet. Some of the trees have been dying because of the salty water flooding from the tidal basin. More than 100 cherry trees have to be cut down, including one tenacious little guy dubbed Stumpy, all to raise the seawall there. We're going to hear about the effort to grow clippings and replant the glorious cherry trees on safer ground. And then, doesn't it feel like the world keeps spinning faster and faster sometimes? Well, actually, that may, in fact, be happening. Just a tick. And no, it's not just the hectic pace of our lives. We're going to talk with a geophysicist who explains what's going on. First now, growing tensions in the relationship between the United States and Israel, and in particular Israeli President Benjamin Netanyahu. The top court at the United Nations unanimously ruled Israel must, without further delay, get food and aid into Gaza. Gaza has been on the brink of widespread famine. Hundreds of aid trucks have been sitting, awaiting entry, lined up just across the border in Egypt. Netanyahu denies Israel is blocking that aid as a weapon of war. Today, Yasmin Abu Taleb, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Barak Ravid, political reporter for Axios, talked with Tiziana Deering and Scott Tong.
So, Barak, first a quick update. Any movement on a ceasefire in Gaza or getting more aid to people who desperately need it?
Well, first, I think the ceasefire is connected to the hostage negotiations, and those are pretty deadlocked at the moment. There were talks until a few days ago in Qatar, but it ended without the real breakthrough. Just a few hours ago, the Israeli Prime Minister's office announced that an Israeli delegation of negotiators will go to Cairo in the next few days to try and, you know, break this logjam. But at least for now, it seems that the gap between Hamas and Israel on this hostage deal is pretty wide.
So to both of you, less than 6 months ago, Biden promised Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu unwavering support after the October 7 attack. Now, flash forward, Monday, the U.S. did not veto a ceasefire resolution at the U.N., allowing it to pass. The reaction, swift. Netanyahu canceled a visit by top Israeli leaders to the U.S. Want to know how consequential this rift is? Yasmin, you first.
I think it's very consequential because there has been, quite a shift in the policy and the public posture in the last couple of months, especially, I think, as the domestic implications of Biden's support of Israel have become much clearer. A number of people I've spoken to have said you can almost sort of trace the shift in their rhetoric, you know, where they started talking a lot more about the suffering in Gaza and being more critical of Israel for not allowing more aid in and sort of allowing these conditions to happen on the ground in Gaza, to when they started really reckoning with the political ramifications in Michigan. And Biden sent a high-level delegation to meet with the Arab and Muslim community in Michigan. In terms of the UN Security Council resolution, it was very notable because they have vetoed the last several resolutions. But at the same time, John Kirby went out there and said, emphasized that this was a non-binding resolution, that this really didn't mark a change in their policy. So I think there's a little bit of confusion in what message they're trying to send by allowing the resolution to go through, but then coming out and seeming to sort of publicly undermine it.
And Barack, hey. Scott, go.
Sorry. Yes. No. I want to ask Barack about that. Your sense of the U.S. appearing to cross its longtime ally Israel at the UN.
Well, I think first it's true that 6 months ago Biden expressed unprecedented support, but he expressed unprecedented support for Israel and not for Netanyahu. And I think this is why we are now where we are, because over the last few months, I think especially in the last 2 months, there's been an understanding in the White House, that growing understanding that Netanyahu is making decisions on the war and on the policy that are more connected to his own political survival and not to Israel's national security interests. And I think that this is when this divergence started. And Biden's trying to, you know, play a very tricky game here of, on the one hand, breaking with Netanyahu, and on the other hand, sticking with Israel, which is, I'm not even sure that this thing is possible. But I think that when you look at the Security Council resolution, I think maybe this is, you know, one of the attempts to play that game. On the one hand, you know, give Netanyahu some sort of a, you know, slap with not vetoing this resolution, but on the other hand, mm-hmm. going right afterwards and saying, you know, there's no change in our policy. We still connect any ceasefire to a hostage deal.
So, Yasmin, what about this tricky game, as Barack calls it, for the White House, right? So we know the Israeli government has uncanceled the visit. Now we'll be in D.C. to discuss plans to invade Rafah in southern Gaza. President Biden has increasingly been frustrated with Israel's approach. Mounting civilian deaths. The U.S. has already crossed Israel at the U.N. So what options does the White House have now to exercise leverage in the Middle East?
Well, I think Barack explained it perfectly when he said Biden pledged unwavering support to Israel, but not to Netanyahu. And so they have been trying this very difficult game of not breaking with Israel and still expressing unwavering support with Israel as a country and its right to retaliate for October 7th, but breaking with Netanyahu because of the way he's pursued the war. And more than that, the way he has just publicly defied Biden and the White House over and over and over throughout this conflict. I mean, he has sort of voiced public disagreement on pretty much every major issue with the White House, despite the unprecedented support Biden has provided him. Though Biden has a number of options to exercise influence on Netanyahu and on Israel if he wants to. But we know from our reporting that he's been highly reluctant to exercise some of the considerable leverage the U.S. has. It could be, you know, the most sort of stark thing would be to suspend weapon sales to Israel. Mm-hmm. But even in between that, you could notify Congress of every weapon sale because that would slow it down and would make it subject to congressional approval and debate. We know a number of Democratic lawmakers are now voicing opposition or at least skepticism of sending so many arms to Israel, given the way the war is being prosecuted right now. Biden really has not been willing to take those steps yet. I think we have to wait and see whether he's willing to notify Congress of more of the weapons transfers, because so far he has circumvented Congress for more than 100 of them.
Mm-hmm. Barack, for now, Prime Minister Netanyahu appears to be standing firm. This week he told U.S. lawmakers that he has to move into Rafah and that a victory against Hamas, in his view, is weeks away, despite what American officials tell him.
Now we are told, you can't do this. If you go into Rafah, you're going to have a humanitarian catastrophe. You're going to have, 30,000 dead. 30,000. Civilian dead. Okay. That's not true. That is simply not true.
Barack, despite mounting criticism from the U.S. and many other governments, do you expect Netanyahu and Israel to proceed and send troops into Rafah?
Listen, I don't know about you, but I guess that a lot of the people who are listening to us right now would agree with me when I say that Netanyahu is not, let's say, has a proven record of not being, let's say, the most credible politician on earth, okay? And, you know, we've seen it time and time and time again. So on Rafah, it's the same thing. The fact that Netanyahu says something doesn't mean that this is what's going to happen. And you know how I know that? Because he issued, I think, four times already, public statements that he approved the plans for an operation in Rafah. I've never heard about a military operation that was approved so many times and still did not happen. And this is why I sort of disagree with Yasmin about the leverage that Biden has over Netanyahu and how he uses it. And I think that the Security Council resolution, in my opinion at least, is much more effective than arms sales when it comes to leverage over Israel. And I think that if you look at when did Netanyahu start talking about Rafah and what happened since then, I think it's a testament to the fact that Biden does have leverage and that the operation Rafah, at least for now, is not going anywhere.
Yasmin, let's talk about voters and leverage over Biden. On Sunday, Vice President Kamala Harris was asked about an Israeli move into Rafah by ABC's Rachel Scott.
Are you ruling out that there would be consequences from the United States?
I am ruling out nothing.
On Tuesday, President Biden was once again heckled by supporters of a ceasefire, this time in North Carolina, but he had a ready response.
They have a point. We need to get a lot more care into his Gaza.
You've already mentioned Michigan, Yasmin. In this election year, is Biden losing voters in key states, key demographics for his support of Israel?
If you look at the landscape right now, then you would say, yes, he is losing support among key parts of his base, at least when you look at polling, approval of his handling of the war and of his support of Israel. Obviously, there's the Arab and Muslim community, but beyond that, there's young voters, there's progressive voters, there's people of color. And it's still early where we don't know how many of these people will ultimately withhold their votes from Biden because of his handling of the war. But I did a story a few weeks ago, and I've done a couple since, about, there is this abandoned Biden movement in Michigan and a couple states. It's unclear how effective that's going to be. Obviously, the uncommitted votes that we saw in a number of these primaries, starting with Michigan. In Michigan, it got over 100,000 votes. In other states, you know, Washington State, they got the uncommitted movement, got two delegates. So this is not an insignificant movement. The campaign will say, well, a lot of these people have said they're doing this to send a message, but have said they're going to support Biden in November because of the stakes of Biden versus Trump. But I think right now it's a bit unclear how many of these voters they can win back, how many of them where this will be a deciding issue where they really are willing to withhold their votes and you know, potentially allow a Trump presidency because of that, and what work Biden does between now and November to try to win some of these people back. I think the efforts so far have fallen short when you talk to these voters that it hasn't really marked a significant change in policy.
We've been talking to Yasmin Abutaleb, White House reporter for The Washington Post, as well as Barak Ravid, political reporter for Axios, covering foreign policy in the 2024 election. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, the cherry trees are blooming in D.C., but there will be fewer of them for a while. More on that in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares Betterment's philosophy on investing.
No matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Get started at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, an automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares why accessibility is central to Betterment's mission.
The real innovation for Betterment was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tech strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging. These are all sort of tricks of the trade.
Learn more about automated investing technology at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
In Washington, D.C., it is peak cherry blossom time. Explosions of pink and white flowers all across the city. especially around the tidal basin by the Jefferson Memorial. And where you have cherry trees, you have loads of visitors and wedding photographers. And you have this. Flooding. See, twice a day when the tide rises, it laps way up above the walkway. It overflows. So you need to have boots or just be okay with wet socks. But for the cherry trees, this is life-threatening.
This water, it's inundating them twice a day, but it's also brackish water, which is very harmful to their roots. So it's the worst sort of condition for a cherry tree to grow in.
That's Teresa Durkin of the Trust for the National Mall. She's a landscape architect. And she says this salty water has been rising at the tidal basin for more than a century.
Maybe people don't know that the tidal basin is a man-made inlet. It's not a natural system by any means. It was built in the late 1800s in response to a major flood that happened in Washington, D.C. So it's 19th century engineering infrastructure. Yeah. And over the last 90 years, the river itself, the Potomac River, has risen almost 11 inches, almost a foot.
And we can see the Potomac, right? I mean, right at that bridge is where it flows into the tidal basin here.
The river itself, the Potomac River, if you look at maps from history, was much wider at one point. All along the river, it's been hardened and channeled, and then you overlay a floodplain map, and you see that the river wins again every time.
Is sea level rise a part of the story, too?
It is. I mean, we have more extreme weather. So when we do have storms, there's even more flooding in the area. And so the Park Service keeps trying to create paths that are a little more away from the edge. But it's somewhat disappointing to people who are crying.
she's thinking about the sea level rise.
It's so disappointing to people who come and want to take the paths around so they can visit all of the different memorials that are now on the tidal basin. And they might not be able to do that if they happen to come when it's high tide. The Park Service is working on repairing. They have a big project that's about to start to raise the level of the wall around the edge, mm-hmm. just so that it can be accessible to people again.
So the plan is to raise the seawall and the walking paths above them by at least 2 feet. And in the process, cut down about 140 cherry trees. And that includes a fan favorite, a small, kind of Charlie Brown Christmas tree in the tidal basin.
Stumpy, of course. There's only one Stumpy.
That is Margaret Pooler, research leader at the National Arboretum just up the road. Stumpy is a grizzled survivor, so nicknamed because it's so much shorter than the other cherry trees. It's got a few remaining branches that all stick out to one side as it stands in pools of water for hours every day. Now, the good news is that Pooler and her team at the Arboretum will be preserving Stumpy's genetic legacy.
Months ago, the Park Service, once they knew that this was probably on the horizon, they came to us and said, hey, we have this tree that's very special, that has a lot of meaning to people. We're wondering if you can help us to save it. And by save it, we don't mean we're going to dig it up and plant it here. Mm-hmm. That just wouldn't work. The tree is too old. Yeah. But what we can do is take cuttings of it and propagate it. And so we will be saving the exact genetic replica of that tree.
In fact, the Arboretum is full of genetic replicas of cherry trees. And some are direct descendants of the original trees that Japan gave to the U.S. as a gift of friendship back in 1912.
So the way that we propagate woody plants here at the National Arboretum is we take a cutting, and that's got to be done at the right time for that species of plant. So depending on the plant, we cut off the tip of the plant, the growing point. These plants, you're not going to see any of those because it's still so early. They're still in flower, and so this is the flower growth. We're talking about vegetative growth, and that hasn't even come out yet.
I see. Okay.
But that would come out after the flowers are done, that you'd see some green, mm-hmm. Fresh, soft growth, and that's what we would cut. And then we would dip that into a rooting compound, which helps to initiate root growth from the end of it. Mm-hmm. After about maybe 4 weeks or so, we'll start to see roots growing. We leave them alone, let those roots develop, and then we'll pot them up into a container probably next spring. And then in a year or so, they'd be big enough to grow, actually plant in the ground.
Oh, you're going to grow them further here for a while before you, you know, send them back to the tidal basin? I mean, what does the timeline generally look like?
So we'll probably grow the stumpy clones here at the Arboretum for at least 2 years. We'll get them to a stage where they're individually potted up, they have strong root systems, they have strong growth, and then we'll work with the Park Service for them to determine where they go next. They wouldn't go straight back out to the tidal basin after 2 years, but the Park Service would have nurseries and places that they would then hold the plants and grow them on till they're ready to put them back out.
So it could be on the order of 5-10 years until Stumpy returns, as it were?
Exactly. I would guess probably the soonest would be probably 5 years before Stumpy, the new Stumpies are ready to be put back out in the tidal basin.
Could we have a lot of Stumpies? Stumpy number one, Stumpy number 10? What are we talking about?
So the number of Stumpies we get from this effort is going to depend on how many good cuttings we can get from the plant. And, you know, you've seen Stumpy. It's not a really strongly growing plant. So every single cutting that we can get, we are going to value that and baby that and, you know, be as careful as we can with it. Yeah. So if we can just get one or a few that are strong growers, we're set really for life, literally.
Sounds hopeful for Stumpy's genetic line, even though Stumpy's own life will soon come to an end.
It is always sad to see a tree cut down. And I think especially a plant like Stumpy that, you know, everyone's rooting for it and now we're finally saying, nope, it's time. But really that's part of something that any public park or area or space, we have to manage our trees for safety and for disease and other things. So this isn't like, what are they doing? This is craziness. Uh-huh. It's just part of, you know, everyone's job when you're managing a public space.
And then each tree, like each human, has a general kind of lifespan. Yeah, I mean, for cherry trees, I gather maybe 40, 50, 60 years, something like that, and that's what we have to keep in mind?
Correct. Nothing is going to last forever, and so we build that into our plan of how and when we're going to replace it when the time comes.
So for now, we enjoy the pink and white beauty of this spring's blossoms.
I think cherry trees, really more than any other landscape plant that I can think of, they cause such, you know, these behaviors and emotions in humans that really no other landscape plant does. So, you know, there's changes going on, there's tragic things happening in the world, and yet these plants are going to bloom year after year. People complain, oh, they're only in bloom for a week or 2 weeks. You know, why can't we make them bloom, you know, for longer? But I think that's part of why they're so valuable is they're only in bloom for a short time. And so you can't say, I'll get to it later, I'll do it. You have to stop what you're doing and go visit those trees because they're not going to be around forever.
And as I listen to her, I think about a trip I made to Japan back in 2011. That was after the deadly tsunami and the whole country was in mourning. And I joined some factory workers at a park in Tokyo. It was cherry blossom season there. And one Japanese friend said, you know, we love the cherry blossom. We love the sakura because it's like life. Beautiful, precious, and fleeting. For now, Stumpy still stands at the tidal basin, if only for a few more weeks.
To have a look at Stumpy and the cherry blossoms, we've got pictures at our website, hereandnow.org. Up next, do you like to make every second count? Well, we may be losing one. Scientists say the Earth is moving faster, and it may cost us about a second. We're going to hear more about what's happening in just a second. Stay with us.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. Try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Bluehost. try Bluehost Cloud, the hosting plan made for WordPress creators by WordPress experts. With 100% uptime, fast load times, and 24/7 support, your sites can handle high traffic spikes. Visit Bluehost.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor, Lisa. Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between Lisa and West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is expertly crafted from natural latex, natural wool, and certified safe foams to elevate your sleep sanctuary and support a greener tomorrow. Plus, every purchase helps fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Visit Lisa.com to learn more. That's LEESA.com.
In this country, more than two local newspapers are closing down each week. As news deserts grow, public radio is a lifeline for staying informed. Keep that service strong with a donation to the NPR network at donate.npr.org. And thank you.
If you think the world is spinning a little too fast, you're onto something. There's evidence the Earth is rotating faster, tiny bit faster. But here's the thing. Because the planet does one revolution quicker, we might have to fix our clocks and subtract a second. Yeah, something like tick, 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 57, 58, zero, skipping a beat. And the planet may coordinate all that in 2029. Whew, what? Yeah, it's a lot to figure out. The good news is we have Duncan Agnew to explain. He's a geophysicist at UC San Diego's Scripps Institution and author of a new study on this in the journal Nature. Professor Agnew, this is complicated, but I understand the Earth is moving faster because of how the core works. Tell us a little more.
Well, the Earth's core is a very large mass of mostly molten iron, and there are currents in it that move around and generate the Earth's magnetic field, which changes with time. We know the core has these motions. We know they change. We don't really know much else. So what is happening, and we actually get this from looking at the rotation, is that the core as a whole is slowing down. It's spin overall spinning a little bit slower, and that causes the rest of the Earth, the solid Earth above it, which is what we live on, to spin a little bit faster.
Okay, so the core spinning slowly means actually the Earth is spinning more quickly overall. I understand this has to do with angular momentum. We won't get into that, the physics there, but you're saying, you know, one day is always kind of approximately 24 hours, not exactly. And that means that our clocks, I gather, have to be adjusted for this faster spinning. They actually have to lose a second. And the question is why? I mean, why don't we just keep our clocks the same? They would be happy and we would be close enough.
The rules for producing the time scale are that our normal time scale is set by atomic clocks. And also that the time scale has to match what the Earth is showing. And since the Earth rotates at variable amounts, every so often there has to be an adjustment. It's like you have two clocks, you have to reset one of them. And so the reset, because the Earth is going, would be going faster than the atomic clock, would be to take a second out of a minute.
Which means we have to fix our clocks, as you're saying, so that these clocks kind of align, right? The atomic clock that I'm looking at on my computer aligns with what's actually happening with the Earth. But I'm kind of thinking, is this Y2K? Could our computers and our clocks kind of flip out trying to minus 1 second?
So a bit of history. Why is this true at all? Why do we do this? Well, in 1972, when this was set up, lots of people used celestial navigation to find where they were by looking at the stars. And for them, it was important that time reflect where the Earth was. That community has dwindled. The community that's grown is, of course, having interconnected computers. And for lots of reasons, you would like those computers to all be on the same time scale. And the problem is, if there's a leap second, then some person has to kind of put that into the computer. If somebody doesn't, then that computer is no longer synchronized with all the others. And the concern is largely that the negative leap second has never happened before. So doing this correctly when it's something you've done before is one thing. Doing it correctly when it's never happened before is another. Now, I can't tell you what the implications are. I'm not sure anybody really knows. And so in the time community, I know there's mostly a desire to not have to have leap seconds either way at this point. The way you would do that is to simply change the rules and say, okay, the timescale we use could depart by more than a second from what the Earth is showing.
We've been talking to Duncan Agnew, geophysicist at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography in San Diego, about time and how our clocks may have to change. Professor Agnew, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This podcast comes to you thanks to the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. Our stories today are produced by Lynn Menigan, James Mastro-Marino, and Julia Corcoran. Our editors are Todd Munt, Peter O'Dowd, Kat Welsh, Micaela Rodriguez, and Michael Scotto. Technical directors are Mike Moschetto, Caleb Green, and Michaela Varela. Mike Moschetto, Max Liebman, and Chris Bentley created the theme music. Our digital producers are Allison Hagen and Grace Griffin. And the executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. I'm Shirley Jihad. Thank you for being with us. Go on, subscribe. See you Monday.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sell without needing to code or design. Just bring your best ideas and Shopify will help you open up shop. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capella University. With Capella's FlexPath learning format, you can earn your degree online at your own pace and get support from people who care about your success. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Taylor Swift has dropped a new album. She is the biggest pop star in the world, and everything she does makes news.
I gasped. I was like, oh my God, I've been there, and you can identify with it.
For a breakdown of Taylor Swift and her new album, The Tortured Poets Department, listen to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.